All right. Give me a hug. I need a hug.
Love you.
I'm Barb. I'm an alcoholic. I gave my lead about 3 a.m. last night. You were excused. I excused him. I told him not to come because he's heard me lead like 10 times. And oh, my goodness. I'll try and shake it up a little bit then. I have not slept in like, 2 weeks or something. I'm having some health problems, and it's just keeping me up aching at night. And I finally fell asleep about 2, and I woke up at 3 o'clock after having this bizarre dream that I couldn't get to the meeting. And I went through, like, there was a fire on the block, and the firemen had sprayed foam that was, like, up to the windows of cars, and I was swimming through it trying to get to the meeting. And I showed up at the meeting, like, 15 minutes late, covered in foam. My car was on the street, so it was impounded by the cops and locked up, and I had to hitch a ride to get to the meeting. It was crazy. And I get here like 15 minutes late, and nobody showed up. It was like 10 people. And I'm like, wow, you know? So I wake up, and then I start speaking, and I couldn't speak. I had laryngitis, and I'm apologizing for this laryngitis. And in the middle of talking, my voice came out, and I literally woke up sitting up in bed speaking. And I'm like, wow. Not only did, like, my fear of not sleeping enough to get up here and speak tonight and having to cancel on her get to me, but God humbled me right there, you know? And I try to remember that all the time, you know. When I came to the meeting last week, I celebrated 30 years. And I don't post that kind of stuff on Facebook because I don't need anybody to congratulate me, you know. I am a productive citizen today. I am not a destructive, vindictive, suicidal, homicidal, angry person that's going to do damage to you. And I don't think anybody needs to be congratulated for behaving in a semi-normal manner. Sobriety's easy. You don't pick up. You get up in the morning. You put on deodorant and you go to work. Okay? And leading an honest program means leading an honest program as much as you can in every aspect of your life. Being an honest person. I'm just going to let it flow. So whatever. Jim, you're getting a different lead tonight. You know, about 15 years ago, I went to Walmart one time and I was just going to pick up a couple things as Christmas party gag gifts. And I walked in, I was like, I'm not even getting a cart. It was Westridge Walmart and they closed at 11 o'clock at the time. It wasn't 24 hours and I picked up a couple things and then it got to be too much. So I grabbed a gift bag and I threw some stuff in this gift bag. And then I was like, oh, I forgot I need a pair of sweatpants. So I went and I picked a pair of sweatpants off the rack, threw it over my shoulder, and I checked out. And there's like 3 employees. One, you know, one's checking me out, one's bagging me. 3 are waiting in the doorway so they don't let any more customers in. And I get in the car and I pull onto Asbury and there's this clunk. I'm like, where's that? What's that clunk coming from? And I come up to 26th Street and I hang a left and there's a clunk again. I'm like, what is that clunk against my window? And it's the sweatpants over my shoulder. I bypassed half a dozen employees and nobody stopped me and I walked out of Walmart with a pair of $14 sweatpants.
Oh, no.
And I went home. I'm like, I'm not going back. It's 11 o'clock and they're stopping people from coming in. So I pulled the tag off. And about a week later, I went back to Walmart, and I paid them for the sweatpants. And everybody's like, are you crazy? Like, you walk past all these people. I go, I don't care about those people, and I don't care about their bottom line. I got to sleep. The most beautiful thing about sobriety today is that when I lay my head down at night, I got nothing bothering me. I got nothing bothering me that I did. Maybe the state of the world or whatever's going on out there, but it's nothing that I did before I lay my head down at night. And you folks taught me that. And then I called my sister, the sister that's in a monastery in Iowa, and I said, oh my God, I turned into her mother. You know, I walked out of Walmart. I'm shoplifting, you know. Because my mother would do crazy stuff like that. You know, she'd come home and unload the groceries, and you'd open the fridge and find the shampoo, you know, just because she was so scattered. I grew up, I'm the 8th of 10 kids, obviously Catholic. And where there's four Catholics, there's always a fifth. That's a quote from Father Martin. And as long as I remember, there was always drinking in my house. And we grew up very poor. And not long before my dad died, I said to him, how did you afford everybody? How did you afford to raise 10 kids? He never collected, you know, there was no food stamps or welfare or anything like that. And he said, it was the family plan back then. Catholic school tuition, family plan. It didn't matter if you had two kids, five kids, whatever, you paid a flat rate tuition. Insurance was the same way. You know, the neighbors had two kids, I had 10, I paid the same rate. So back in the day, you could afford 10 kids. But I was in seventh grade before I got my first brand new pair of winter boots. When we were growing up, I remember distinctly, it starts snowing one night, and we're like, it's snowing, and my mother's like, oh, it's not sticking to the ground, don't get so excited, you know, and it's like, no, Ma, it's snowing, you know, and she goes, Mike, my older brother, go down to the basement and get the box. So my brother comes up with this giant box, she says, dump it on the floor. Dumps it on the floor. She says, whatever boots fit you are yours. And that's what happened every year. I was in seventh grade before I got my first brand new pair of boots. And I can tell you what they looked like. You know, they were zip up. They were kind of like this caramely color. And they had these rubber heels on them. I thought I was something else. Well, I heard a lead last week, and this gal started her lead off. She said, you know, the first time in life that I felt uncomfortable. And I went, wow, what a way to start your lead off. And what a thought. When was the first time in life that I really felt uncomfortable, you know? And I don't know why, but maybe it's an age thing, but lately these things are popping up and they're really making me question things, you know, and making me think about things instead of just accepting why they are. And I was pretty okay with life, I really was, until sixth grade. And I was in the Sacred Heart area, which is, you know, lower middle class to middle class. Most people worked at a shop or they were self-employed. And we moved to a neighborhood and transferred to St. George's. And now I come from a family of immigrants. My dad immigrated here after World War II. My grandmother immigrated before World War I. And my mother actually flunked first grade because she didn't know enough English because my grandmother spoke Polish to her all the time. And as we grew up, my parents spoke Ukrainian, Polish, kind of a mix to each other. And to this day, I can't speak anything other than Ja nie rozumiem, I don't understand you. And now I forget the phrase of, I don't want anything more to eat or drink. Like, you can survive a trip to Ukraine just knowing those three things. But I can sit at a dinner party where everybody's speaking Ukrainian and translate for another non-Ukrainian speaking person, which I've done. But I can't respond in Ukrainian. So I grew up with that old country mentality where you never bought anything you wanted, you only got what you needed. And 6 years ago, when I was 50 years old, I took out a 30-year mortgage and I bought a new house. Because it occurred to me, maybe that wasn't the greatest way to live. Maybe it would be really nice to be in a neighborhood where I could go and sit out on the porch at night and feel safe. And where I could talk to my neighbors and not have them be schizophrenics or cooking meth in the back garage, you know? And so it took a lot of prayer. There's been a lot of growth in the last 10 years. I started packing stuff up about 10 years ago, and I filled my dining room up with all the stuff I didn't want anymore. And I told these, you know, my friends at work and my other, you know, friends, I said, come over, and if there's anything you want, just take it. And I'm getting rid of everything else. So my friends showed up, and they're like, why are you getting rid of all this stuff? I said, because I'm moving. And they go, where? I said, I don't know. And they said, when? I go, I don't know. All I know is I'm moving, and I'm not staying here. And they're like, you're crazy. I go, no, I'm praying. I'm praying a lot, you know. My nieces were at my house one night, and they were complaining about my sisters, you know, their mothers. And I'm like, man, I go, you know, when I'm not around, what are they saying about me? And they're like, oh, no, we can't tell you. I'm like, come on, you know, I'm your Bubba. You can tell me what's being said about me. And they're like, if we tell you, you swear you won't let them know. And I'm like, okay, I swear. They hate it that you can make decisions so quickly. I go, that's their criticism? Really? That's their criticism. I go, that's a compliment. And I go, girls, I want to tell you something else. Now, this is a week after my older brother says, hey, younger brother's selling his car. Who wants it? I said, I do. How much you want for it? I told him 2 years ago I'd buy it from him. And they're like, pfft. And I go, how much you want? I said, okay, we'll go to the bank on Monday. I'll get you the money. He's like, really? I go, credit's good. Trust me. I'm buying the car. Well, they were just stonewalled by that, you know? And I said, girls, I already got a copy of Mark's insurance policy, compared it to my insurance policy. 2 years ago, I Kelly Blue Booked the value of his car. I know I'm getting a good deal, and when I buy this car, I'm going to save money to boot. So I don't make decisions quickly. I've already done the homework. Why do I bring this up? When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was unemployable. I quit my job before I was fired because I was drinking too much, and I showed up at work one day and I was drunk. And when I sobered up and I had to find another job, I sat down and I tried to compose my resume, and I like literally went into a panic and I could not do it. I couldn't compose my resume for like the first 10 years of my sobriety. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I'm at a family gathering. My brother calls up a guy that was running a division of his company and said, hey, Rick, Barb needs a job. Do you need help? He's like, Barb, tell her to start on Monday. Now, I had sobered up in the meantime from quitting my old job to then. And the reason I sobered up was when I quit my job, a week later, this nice little $1,200 check appeared in the mail. They cashed out a 401k I didn't even know. And I'm like, hey, I can sit on my butt and drink for a while, right? I sat in the middle of my living room and I drank and I drank and I drank and I drank until I couldn't get drunk anymore. And it was that spot in the big book where they talk about that jumping off place, that loneliest place you can get to. And I couldn't get drunk anymore and I didn't know what to do. I couldn't feel good. I couldn't feel bad. I couldn't feel anything. And at the same time, a cicada starts chirping. And when the cicadas go off, at any time, I'm reminded of that day. Because I thought, that's what I'm like. I'm like the cicada shells that are stuck to the tree. There's this skeleton there, and there's absolutely nothing inside. I am completely empty. I drank so much that I couldn't even bend over the sink to spit out toothpaste because my guts hurt so bad. I drank so much. When I was in college, I'd get up in the morning, I'd go to class, I'd come back, I'd drink, I'd go to my part-time job, I'd come back and I would drink, and I'd get up and do it all again. At one point in college, I needed a prescription, and I wasn't allowed to drink on it. And I'm like, who writes a prescription like that? Well, I was in school in Cleveland. I came home to see my doctor, and I think he did it to me on purpose. Because I would come home, you know, for an annual checkup, and he was taking blood from me. And I'm like, why are you, why are you taking my blood? I'm like, I'm too young to be taking blood, you know, and I'm not complaining about anything. He goes, your mother wants me to check your liver. I was like, well, how's my liver? He goes, it's still doing pretty good. I said, all right, cheers. And off to the races again. So he prescribes me, I had a bronchial thing. He prescribes me this antibiotic. I can't drink for 5 days. So I went back to school and I waited till Sunday night. So I could take it Sunday through Thursday because there was no way I was going through a weekend without drinking, you know. That was the only dry spell that I had other than a 28-day stay in detox when I was 21. On May 13th of 1989, I walked into my mother's house. It was Mother's Day. And I said, I don't have a present for you, but I've been sober for 24 hours. And she said, that's all I wanted, and that's all I need. And when I walked into my first AA meeting, I was becoming agoraphobic. When I wasn't going to work, I refused to leave my house. I would just sit in my house and drink. I would literally look outside on a sunny day like this and go, I'm missing this. I can't even go outside. I'm afraid people are going to see me. What if the neighbors want to talk to me? I was terrified. I couldn't drive without panic attacks. It was horrible. So a shrink suggested I come to AA. And he told me to go to the responsibility group on Saturday night and look for a gal named Maureen. And so I did on Saturday night. And I walked up, and this old guy walks up to me and he says, can I help you, honey? I said, yeah, I'm here to look. Is Maureen here? And he goes, no, she didn't come tonight. And I'm like, full panic mode. He goes, come on, I'll get you a cup of coffee. And he grabbed me by the elbow and he walked me in. I introduced. I sat through the meeting. He says, what are you doing tomorrow night? Sunday morning I went to the hospital. There was a Sunday morning meeting at St. Vincent's, and then I went to my mother's house. And then he said, I'll go to this meeting on Dutch Road on Sunday nights. And I said, I can't drive that far because my panic attacks. He's like, meet me back where responsibility group was at the YWCA on Westridge Road. So I would park there. Clarence would pick me up, take me out to Fairview, and then take me back to my car. And then the next night he says, I'll see you at St. Vincent's. I said, okay. So I went to St. Vincent meeting. The next night he says, I have to go to a Shrine Club meeting. Honey, she ain't bothering me none. Don't worry about it. Let her play. Seriously, I don't care. I've been sober 30 years. Like, a little, you know, have fun, Munchkin. Just don't knock anybody's coffee over. So Tuesday night he had a Shrine Club's meeting, and he says, I want you to go to this meeting. There's a 12 and 12 meeting at 21st and Washington near your house. Tell me what it's about on Wednesday night at Responsibility Group. So I did that. And I walk in the rooms, and I'm at Responsibility Group, and Dana and Michelle and Bob get up. they're celebrating 3 months of sobriety. And I'm like, hey, these guys can stay sober for 3 months. I'm going to do that. I can do 3 months. So I hung in there, and sure enough, I had 3 months of sobriety. But these guys get up, and they're celebrating 6 months. So I'm like, dang. So I went for it again. 6 months, right? Sure enough, I get 6 months. Guess who's got 9 months? I'm like, dang. I get 9 months. They got a year. I'm dying. So I sober up in May, and TJ asked me to chair the meeting in December. And I'm like, okay. Right? TJ got holy hell for that, because I didn't have a year of sobriety. And he says to the home group, find somebody that'll chair it in December then. Because of the holidays, nobody will take it. That kept me sober that December, because I was going to be damned if I was going to come back to that group and reintroduce. And I white-knuckled it through the holidays, but man, I did not pick up. So after I get my year, they get up and say, how you did it? I went to a meeting every day. Thank you very much. I sat down. 2 years. I went to a meeting every day and sat down. I'm like, I'm not happy. I would literally go to the responsibility group and hear everybody going out afterwards and doing all this stuff. And I would get in the car and I would go home and I would literally cry because I was so damn lonely. So then it was suggested to me that I get a female sponsor. So I met Sandy Green, and I asked her to sponsor me. And I started working the steps. And one was easy. I mean, I knew I was an alcoholic, like when I was 16 years old. Didn't bother me at all. My life was so unmanageable. This lead I heard last week, not only was I uncomfortable, but I just was never happy. There was never a point in my life where I was happy. I never enjoyed anything. So I get to step two, and I knew I was insane. You know, you guys are going to restore me to sanity. I was willing to do anything, because the concept of even having sanity was something totally foreign to me. You know, when I was growing up, you know, if anything bad happened, like anybody was picking on you at school or you broke up with your boyfriend, if I cried about it, you know, or whined to my mother, she'd be like, there's more fish in the sea. Oh, just ignore them. Da-da-da-da-da, whatever. And one time she asked me, she says, Barbara, the girls at school are picking on your little sister, and I know you had that problem. Tell her how you solved it. I go, oh, that's easy, Donna. I go, the next time one of us is picking on you, turn around and slug them as hard as you can, and that'll stop it. She's like, Barbara! And I'm like, well, Ma, how do you think I stopped it? I mean, I hit Annette right square on the jaw, and nobody ever picked on me again. So that was my answer to everything. If anybody was going to tussle with me, I was fighting back. I never learned to process anything. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That was tough. I mean, I was scared of that step more than any other step. And it took a lot. It took a lot. I read this book that said, if you really want to develop a relationship with a higher power, take everything you've learned and throw it out the window. Everything. Throw it out the window and start praying. And your God, your concept of God will come to you. So I leave the meeting one night. I'm bawling my eyes out. I get home. I'm lonely. What's on the late show? And Godspell comes on. I had never seen it before. And I'm like, hey, you know, it beats a there was a horror thing on Friday night something, I don't know, but it was a horror thing. And when I got sober, I got really sensitive and I couldn't like watch gore anymore. So I turned on Godspell and I was mesmerized. The exuberance and the joy and everything that these actors were portraying, just like, and I'm sitting in my living room and all of a sudden this incredible feeling of peace just washed over me. And I said, that's the answer. I found God in my living room. And so I started really trying to maintain what the, you know, we call a conscious contact with God. And I said, how do you do that? And people were telling me, you just try to talk to him as much as you can during the day. Well, I am like, one of my therapists said I had ADD, attention to detail disorder. So I get so focused on work that, you know, thinking of anything spiritual in the day wasn't happening. So I started writing CC on post-it notes. And I put it in the desk where my pens are, put it on my computer screen, put it on my makeup mirror. So all throughout the day, when I reached for anything, looked at anything, it reminded me to constantly have conscious contact with God. And I still do that today. Like if something ruffles my feathers at work, I'd be like, still, get still. And I can drop into that peace, boom. Oh, it's a lovely place to be. So I get to my fourth step, you know, and I said to my sponsor, I call my sponsor, I go, I got a problem, man. I get to the emotional part of it, and all I get is anger and shame, anger and shame. There's no in between. If I'm pissed about something, if I have resentment against you, I'm either, it's homicidal or suicidal. I'm either going to hurt you or I'm going to hurt me, and there ain't any in between. Like, I was mean. You did not want to date me because I would make mincemeat out of you. And I'm talking for like the first 20 years of sobriety too, okay? She's like, honey, you need a counselor. So I go to see this counselor. I'm 6 years sober. It actually was a shrink I used to babysit for when I was before my drinking took off. And he walked in to offer his condolences at my mother's wake. So I talked to him, and he's like, yeah, call my office, come see me. And so I went to see him. And what he did was he had me write down, you know, who do you have a resentment against, and tell me the story. And I would go in, and I'd tell him the story, and he'd go, oh, so your sister did that. So you're sorely disappointed in her. I go, no, I want to kill her. And he's like, no, honey, you're sorely disappointed. And then at that time, that poster came out with the guy's face with all the different emotions, overwhelmed, embarrassed, shy, you know. I was like, I need like a pocket card, like, you know, so I can just pull it out and register what I'm feeling. Like, serious, I had to think everything through, the most basic, basic thing. So, I mean, it's been a journey. Blows me away. 30 years sober, I'm still learning stuff. When was the first time I was uncomfortable, you know? And poor Mary Ida. She comes up to me this last week and she goes, do you want to grow in the program? And I looked at her. I looked at her like... She's like, what's the matter? I'm exhausted. And she's like, what do you want? Just tell me what you want, Mary Ida. She's like, I want you to lead next week. I go, that's easy. I can do that. Okay. I was like, I hope I just gave her the I'm exhausted look and I'm not going to kill you, Mary Ida look, you know? I was just like, you got to be kidding me. So, why do I bring that up?
Oh, because you're still growing.
I'm still growing. I have no sense. Last week, she asked me, I had spent all day Sunday, I drove out to Charlie's gravesite, and I dug up Charlie's gravesite, and I planted flowers, and it was a mess. So I beat myself to a pulp out there, and then came home and beat myself to a pulp in my own yard. So this weekend, I left work early on Friday night, and I tore up Judy Smith's yard and weeded that out. And then I got up on Saturday, and I figured, oh, what the hell? I already am, like, throbbing. So I went and spent 5 hours in my sister's yard and tore that one up. And people will say to me, why do you do that to yourself? And I'm driving here tonight, and I thought, yeah, why do I do that to myself? We gotta think this one through. And I had a growing moment on the car ride here, okay? And the reason I do that to myself is I know I have limitations, okay? My health problems, I'm afraid to commit to anything too big because I'm afraid I'm not going to be well enough to show up, okay? And, like, I didn't go to the retreat this weekend because I got sick the last couple years. I don't know if it's the woods or whatever. And I'm flying out on Sunday to see Charlie's sister in South Carolina. So I'm not real big on sponsoring. I feel that there's some people that are just better equipped to do it, you know. I guess I don't like to revisit my past. It makes me very uncomfortable to think how sad and depressed and suicidal and homicidal and miserable I was. And so it's really hard for me to listen to somebody that doesn't want to put deodorant on and get up and go to work, you know. So I'm not good at some things, but one thing I'm really good at is rape and pillage gardening, okay? So I'm trying to do for people... See, I knew it was going to get me. I'm trying to do for people what I can do. And that's what I can do. My sister has lupus, and you all know Judy has cancer. And that's what I can do for them. I can go over there so they're not, you know. I asked somebody to ask Judy what she needed from me. And she goes, tell Barb I really want my bushes trimmed. I look out and it's making me crazy. Really? Okay, so I showed up with the hedge trimmers Friday night. I had her front yard weeded out and the bushes trimmed and everything, and then went in the house and she's like, what are you doing here? I go, man, I've been out in your yard for 2.5 hours. You know, if you feel well enough, like, stick your head out the window. I did a great job. Yeah. I do what I can do. And if sponsoring is not my forte, I'll try to help you out the best as I can as my health allows it, you know. So I went from this homicidal, suicidal person to doing my fourth step and then doing my fourth step again when I was 23 years sober. And I was doing it because I was sponsoring two gals. And I said, let's get the Joe McHugh book. And when we did that fourth step, Joe adds a little thing, another column on the end that's not in the big book. And it's, what did you have to do to contribute to that? So I have a resentment with my sister because she did this and it affects my self-esteem and my, you know, social status, blah, blah, blah. And what do you have to do with that? Well, not that I, you know, poke her or aggravate her or make her do it all again, you know. Or, you know, if you're having trouble at work, you know, what do you have to do with that? Well, I don't lighten up on the people. I just go at them harder, you know. So it really shined a light on me and how I was contributing to all the crap in my life. So literally, when I run into a situation where I'm having a problem with somebody in my life now, I can four-step it in my head. This, ooh, wow, she said that to me. Popped up a resentment. Why did it pop up a resentment? What's it aggravating? And what's my response going to be? Oh, I'm sorry you feel that way. You know? Well, try to do better next time. And all the crap in my life, like, washed away. I get along with everybody at work. My family comes to my house for the holidays. Like, when did I become the family matriarch? I got one niece living with me. My younger niece... her BFF is living in my basement. I got two people living with me now. So I got the niece, this one coming in and this one going out, and the parents are showing up, and my house is like one freaking party, and I supposedly live alone. I don't know. So I go through this fourth step, right? And I wish I was small enough to ride that. Does the bell work? Does the bell work?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah, let her ride down the back of the room. So, here I am 23 years sober, and, you know, I've gone through all the steps and everything, but doing that fourth step, the Joe McHugh way, really set off a change in me. And I met Charlie. Now, if you don't know the story of Charlie, I turned on my computer one night and somebody posted pictures of the New Year's dance. And there was this smiling guy. And I'm like, who is that guy? And my friend came over because we were going to do dinner and a meeting. And I go, did you see Diane's pictures on Facebook? And she goes, yeah. I go, did you see that guy? She goes, what guy? I go, the guy with the smile. She goes, I don't know who you're talking about. Is your computer still up? I go, yeah. So I take her over, and she goes, him? I go, yeah. She goes, you like? I go, yeah, I like. She goes, well, let's find him. I go, how are we going to do that? She goes, we'll hunt him down. Okay. Now, if this was one of my sisters, they would have said, you know, you got all the stuff going on at work, you just bought the house, you're busy, you're this and that, and the other thing, I was in the middle of a remodel of this new house. Oh, we'll hunt him down. This is a friend, man, you know? I had never stalked anybody in my life. Hey, I'm 49, it's about time to start, right? So we did. We started, she's like, she called Jilly. Yeah, okay, he's an East Sider. Let's go to Wesleyville tonight. We go out to Wesleyville. We walk in. Susan Twining runs up, and she goes, is one of you gals leading? And we're like, no. And she's like, ah, our chairperson didn't show up. We don't know who's supposed to lead. And Kathy goes, well, I'll chair and Barbara lead. She's like, really? And I'm like, sure, yeah, why not? And so Susan's like, thanks. And she runs away, and I turn to Kathy. I go, what'd you do that for? She goes, I didn't want to lead. Great friend. Took us 3 weeks to find Charlie. He was nowhere on the east side. He was at the west side group on Friday night because he was subbing for Steve B for the bowling league. Finally, I run into him. Well, Jilly let the cat out of the bag because he kept turning and looking at me during the meeting. And I'm like, Jilly let it out of the bag, Kath. So we got to talking, and he's like, hey, why don't you come back next week? I got a sub for bowling for 6 weeks. Why don't you come back to the meeting next week and then come to the bowling alley and we'll hang out while I bowl? I said, okay. So I went to the bowling alley next week and we just got to talking. And when bowling was done, Charlie walked me out to my car and he goes, you know, this is really uncomfortable for me. He goes, I feel like you asked me out. And I go, I don't know what you're talking about, because I don't remember anybody picking up the phone and asking anybody to dinner or a movie or anything like that. You have a good night, Charlie. And I got in my car and I drove off. And he waited the requisite 3 days, and he picked up the phone. How would you like to do dinner on Saturday? Oh, that would be lovely. So we had our first date. The following week, I think, was Valentine's Day, right? I bought him a small gift, because I didn't like, you know, I already stalked the guy. He knows this, right? I didn't want to freak him out. So I buy him a small gift. And he bought me a teddy bear. And roses and chocolate and a card. And he's like, hey, if you're going to do Valentine's Day, you do it right. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I met him, I think it was like January 18th or the next week We had our first date February 5th. We had Valentine's Day. March 15th, he proposed. And I said yes. It was this, there was just like no doubt. There was just no doubt. When I was with him, I was never trying to be anybody else. I was just Barb. He was just Charlie. And we fit. On April 11th, he had a brainstem stroke. On April 19th, he died. And the following Monday, we buried him. I spent 16 years with Clarence Nelson from the time he took me by the elbow and walked me into the rooms of AA. And that man treated me with respect, love, dignity. Never pulled anything. And I needed that. There were guys that said they would not ask me out because they didn't want to go through Clarence. And I go, if you weren't going to make it past Clarence, I don't want to go out with you anyway. And when I met Charlie, I found I couldn't even get mad at him. I just couldn't even get mad at him. Like one day, you know, my feathers were ruffled. And I'm like, Charlie, why are you doing that? And he goes, because if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I'm like, I can't even get mad at this guy. What is going on? You know? It was right. I was crushed. Crushed. You know, somebody posted a meme on Facebook the other day. Your bottom will teach you more than sitting on a mountain summit. I was absolutely crushed. When I stood, I had to go in the MICU 8 days straight. And when I stood at those doors, I would stand at the doors and say, God help me. And I would hit the button to open the doors and go in and deal. I've known his family for 3 months, and I got all these people that are grieving around me, and I got to deal with them. And I could have only done it because I was able to apply everything that you guys taught me in this program. I was so uncomfortable for months. I would get up. I would plan my day so I didn't have to be home alone. The person that can be alone all the time finally met somebody she wanted to be with, and then I couldn't be alone anymore. And that went on for a couple months until I watched this program. It was Oprah interviewing this woman who had lost her mother and her two daughters in a Christmas Eve fire. And this woman said, everybody thinks these kind of tragedies happen to somebody else. All these tragedies happen to somebody else. They never happen to us, but they do happen to us. You know, you do lose people. People break up with you. They end friendships, and it hurts. And the reason it hurts is because you didn't end it. And you have all this love for this person, and you don't know what to do with it, so you stuff it down, and you stuff it down. And that's why it physically and emotionally hurts. So when you're grieving, you take that love and don't stuff it down. You take it and you let it out, because there's a lot of people in this world that need a lot of love. And I thought about it. And I'm like, Charlie's family, his friends, they knew him a lot longer than I did. And they're hurting too. So I started going to the East Side meetings. And I started hanging out with this family. And I tried to take that love that Charlie laid on me and I had for him. And I tried just to love them. And what happened is I lost my fiance, but I gained 100 friends. And I gained another family. And the grief wasn't as bad. You know, one of the guys at work told me to look at this success is based on your happiness. And the happiness is an inside job, and the success is a byproduct of it. You will never find a truly successful person that is a grump. And I came to the conclusion, after a long time of grieving, that Charlie just wanted to love somebody. And God said, you're going to walk him home. You know, God will only give you what you can handle, and my higher power thinks I'm one big badass, because that one hurt. But it was an honor, and it was a privilege. And I would never have gone from the shy little girl that Clarence Nelson had to pour coffee for to the lady that's standing in front of you today that knows she beats herself to a pulp because rape and pillage gardening is just, you know, one of her positive attributes, I guess. So I might look nice tonight, but my fingernails are really in bad shape still.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bart. You're an inspiration. Here's your paycheck. What an inspiration.